I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Benjamin Story, the Jane Gage Hipp Professor in European and American Political Thought, and Jenna Silver Story, Assistant Professor, both in Politics and International Affairs at Furman University. We're discussing their 2021 book, Why We Are Restless, on the Modern Quest for Contentment, from Princeton University Press. Ben and Jenna Story work on modern political thought, as well as the notion of liberal education, and have written several articles on this topic. First of all, Ben Story, let me welcome you to the Political Theory Review.
Thanks very much, Jeff. It's a great honor to be here, and I'm really glad to talk with you about the book today.
Yes, and I wish we could have had Jenna here today, but Jenna couldn't make it. But I'm sure you'll fill in for very big shoes. Ben, let me say first of all, I loved the book. I thought it was an excellent analysis of the four French thinkers that you talk about in your analysis of the modern view of flourishing or happiness. You really sort of tackle this issue head on about restlessness that we see so much in not just our students, but ourselves more broadly. So well done on the book. Let me ask you, first of all, why you wrote the book in the first place. What was the motivation?
Well, thanks, Jeff. We started thinking about this theme because of something that we were seeing in our students. And the book actually begins with a portrait of a student who's a composite, but a composite based on a number of real experiences, which is that we kept noticing that the top flight students that we were teaching would frequently get to the fall of their senior year and have a kind of breakdown. And the people we're thinking about are people who were doing everything that the college, our college, but many colleges were suggesting they ought to do to succeed, and were nonetheless finding themselves kind of paralyzed and miserable. We saw this restlessness among them, and the specific form that it would take is that, we're looking at people who oftentimes will have more than one major, as is frequently the fashion these days. They're typically doing very well in all of them. They'll study abroad. Sometimes they'll study abroad more than once. They're socially engaged. They're joining clubs on campus. They're founding clubs on campus. They're doing lots of internships and preparing themselves for career in that sense. But they come to what could be seen as the first really major choice in life, the choice of what they're going to do after they graduate, and they don't know what to do with themselves. And so there's something about their educations that doesn't prepare them to choose. And this is the thing that we, that's the restlessness, that's part of the restlessness that we're seeing, is that people are doing lots of things, they may even be doing those things well, but figuring out what my life ought to be aiming toward, that is really very difficult for our students. And we've noticed this in our summer teaching with students elsewhere, with kids from around the country. So we saw this in our students, and of course we see it in ourselves. Jenna and I are like many two career professional couples we've got three kids. We run around a lot, doing a tremendous variety of things, and we talk about the need to cut back, and as so many people do, and we find it's exceedingly difficult. And so we started to wonder why is this the case? And we noticed, and then this just reminded us of a famous line in Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, which is Tocqueville, he comes to this country, he sees that modern Americans are the freest, most enlightened, most prosperous people the world has yet seen. And he says, yeah, but they're restless in the midst of their prosperity. And that's the theme that we wanted to think about. And so we noticed that Tocqueville got to that theme in part by just looking at us, but in part because he was drawing from this deeper French tradition. And so that's how this book became a book about that whole tradition.
Yeah, good. And you examine, Tocqueville concludes the book. There's the fourth chapter. You also talk about Montaigne, Pascal, Rousseau, and Tocqueville, which forms, I think, a really nice dialogue in modern history about this topic. I wanted to ask you just first of all, why, you know, why you chose those four thinkers in particular. I mean, so you mentioned there, you know, Tocqueville's insight. You know, why these four thinkers? Why did you go with the, you know, French tradition there, for example?
Good. So, you know, there's no pretense in the book to be a comprehensive treatment of this tradition. All these thinkers belong to a French tradition that's called the tradition of the moraliste. And the word moraliste in French, it's not what moralizer, like we might say in an English sense. I think there's a great translation of that term as observers of men. The moralists are great observers of human things. And you could include a lot more thinkers in a book like this one. People like La Rochefoucauld, La Bruyère, these are names that naturally come to mind when one considers this sort of thing. We were looking to create a certain kind of conversation about happiness that entertained certain options really seriously, so as to help ourselves, help our readers think through these different approaches to happiness and which of these kinds of approaches to happiness might help us deal best with the restlessness that is in some ways natural to the human soul. And in other ways, we think, takes a specific and some ways kind of exacerbated form in modern life. And that's something I think will come out as we work our way through the authors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to, you know, be clear about the aim of the book, because that, you know, the motivation is very, you know, is very vivid in reading through the book. One of the things I wanted to ask was sort of, you know, what do you intend with this analysis of these four thinkers? Is the idea to, you just sort of illuminate this tradition of happiness? Is the idea, I mean, yours is not clearly not a self-help book that stands on Barnes & Noble bookshelves along other, you know, you're not prescribing a certain view of the good, but so to put it in this way, how might understanding, you know, this kind of debate help students or modern peoples in general with this restlessness as you describe it?
Actually, I'm glad you bring up the phrase self-help. Our editor at Princeton University Press, Rob Tempio, actually does think of what he does as in part publishing books of high-minded self-help. And so we're actually not, it doesn't bother us if people notice that this book is a little bit self-helpy. At the same time, it's a certain kind of, I hope it's at least high-minded in its self-help
at the highest level. Right.
And so, you know, the way we're trying to do that is we think these are four really powerful perspectives on the question of happiness, and we want to help people think them through. And so we do what comes very naturally to us because of what we learn from our teachers and what we try to practice in our classrooms, which is that we're the lawyer for each of the authors we consider. We try to make the best case we can for Montaigne, for Pascal, for Rousseau, for Tocqueville. And we think it is helpful. We think it can help people think better about happiness to walk through each of these options. This is not to say that, and at the end of the day, we're agnostic on this question. We have views, like anybody does, and those views have specifically to do with the question of the highest good and the question of choice that we began by talking about and thinking about students. And so we're looking to rehabilitate something of the place of reason with respect to the choices human beings have to make about how they live. If one wanted to say what the book is, what the overall sort of bottom line of the book is, I would say that it's something like that, that we want to rehabilitate a kind of zetetic skepticism, a searching skepticism that doesn't assume from the outset that it is not possible to think your way to an answer about the question of the good. Then we think that presumption comes in many ways from the first thinker we deal with, Montaigne. And I wrote my dissertation about Montaigne. I love Montaigne, but I think there's a way in which his skepticism is something we sort of breathe in like a gas. And that's T.S. Eliot's phrase about this. And I think it paralyzes our thinking about how we should live.
Mm-hmm. It just occurred to me to ask this question, but out of these four thinkers, which one excites your students the most? Mm-hmm. I mean, I was going to say, you know, it's just sort of Rousseau is often the one that is, I haven't really taught Montaigne or Pascal, but, you know, Rousseau is certainly one of these figures who really animate students in a kind of way. Do you find any of the, you know, think about which one is the one that really said, wow, transforms the students?
Well, it's that's a really good question. I mean, I had, there's a famous, and I don't know that I know the answer, actually, because my students, different students get excited about different authors. I'll tell you just a funny story about this, that one day I was, one semester when I was teaching Montaigne to my students, they showed up, maybe it was April Fool's Day, they a bunch of them showed up to class in rough collars, like Montaigne wore, and they were holding cabbages because cabbages have this role in the essays. And so Montaigne says about death that I want death to find me planting my cabbages, but nonchalant about it and still more about my unfinished garden. This is a very famous line from the essays. And that's just one place where the cabbages show up in therein. And so they were fixated on this. And so I went home that day with about, you know, a dozen cabbages that I didn't know what to do with. But so they, you know, they love, you know, really good students have loved Montaigne. I think he charms people the most powerfully. I think Pascal troubles them the most. And I think that's the, in that sense, you know, he may be the one who points out something to people that they find to be true, but wouldn't have seen without his help, to an extent that, I don't know if I've seen that as clearly in the others, but you know, if for political philosophy people who are teaching, they're all great. they're all students warm to all this stuff.
Yeah, good. So let's jump into Montaigne. I thought we could just begin by talking about the view that Montaigne is challenging or fighting against, because in part you situate Montaigne as a kind of, you know, watershed figure in modern thought, as a figure who's inaugurating a new tradition of thinking about happiness, using the helpful distinction between, you say, a transcendent view of happiness versus an immanent conception. Montaigne is much more on the side of defending an immanent conception of happiness. So maybe you could say a little bit about the view that Montaigne is fighting against, an ancient or Christian conception, and you know what his case is against it.
So, yeah, I think that, you know, this is Montaigne's place in history is really something best understood against that historical backdrop. And so, as anybody who's read him knows, Montaigne is steeped in the classical and Christian tradition. He can quote, you know, a huge array of philosophers and poets and less prominently theologians, but he knows them. He can quote this stuff from memory, very fluidly. He's an extraordinarily learned man. So what did he get from the classical and Christian tradition, and how does he challenge it or innovate on it? So Montaigne sees this tradition, the way we describe it is that it's typified by three kinds of characters: philosophers, citizens, and saints, is the way that you might think of these three kinds of characters. And those three kinds of characters all, of course, think, they have different opinions about the best way to live. They have radically different opinions in many cases about the best way to live, and they're often in contest with one another. But there's something that they have in common. And this something is the search for the one thing needful, the pearl of great price, as the language of the Gospels have it. And we think you can see this most clearly by thinking about that famous statement of Socrates in the Apology, that the unexamined life is not worth living for a human being. Until I started thinking about that in comparison to Montaigne, I always took it to be kind of hyperbolic, but I don't think it is. I think Socrates is really serious. In other words, like, life without philosophy is not worth anything. Like, it is better not to be alive. And I think that view that there's something that makes the difference between a life worth living and a life that it would really be better not to live at all is, I think, common to all the different poles of this tradition. So if we think about, you know, the notion of the citizen, if we think about a Cato or a Leonidas at Thermopylae, these are people who think, if I'm not going to be a citizen, if I'm not going to be a free participant in the government of my country, I would rather be dead. That is because the alternative is slavery, and slavery is worse than death. If we think about the Christian perspective, life without the gospel is hell on earth and damnation hereafter. It is, once again, not worth living. And so Montaigne comes along and he looks at all this and he says, this is just a radically false way to think about human things. He thinks that merely living is something worthwhile in and of itself. And this is his famous little sort of conversation he imagines in the book, that in the essays that I think captures this. He has somebody say, as many of us often do, I haven't done anything today. And then he responds and he says, what, have you not lived? That is not only the most illustrious, but the most fundamental of your occupations. Or I think I got that backwards. It's the most fundamental and illustrious of your occupations. Merely living. So what does he mean? He means eating and drinking and traveling and reading and being part of a family and gardening, but not too well. And doing all the things that take up so much of our lives, not with any particular focus on any of them, but the ordinary activities of human existence. He says those ordinary activities can make a life worth living. Not by identifying the pearl of great price, but by having lots of different little pearls. And so, there's a great line from Pierre Manon, whose work I know you know. You know, Manon says about Montaigne. Montaigne is the guy who offers something to people who don't care either about the salvation of the city of their cities or the salvation of their souls. Right? It's like, you know, I don't particularly care about going to heaven, and I don't particularly care about politics either. I just want to enjoy myself. Montaigne is a very beautiful illustration of that possibility. That's what's new.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I'm curious about this notion of, you know, mere life as opposed to the good life, maybe as Aristotle put it, or any of the ancients really, because it sounds like it's not, you know, the sort of, you know, life of pleasure that, you know, say Aristotle would have talked about in contrast to the active life or the contemplative life. There's a whole bunch of different activities that Montaigne sounds like he's advocating for, right? And it does, I mean, it's just, I mean, the relevant distinction seems to be more of a democratic versus an aristocratic conception of happiness. That is that, you know, he's advocating for forms of flourishing that are accessible to the wide variety of peoples, in contrast to the ancient conception, which is you have to be a sage or a saint, which takes extreme rigor and is available really only to the few and the privileged to access. So is it, I mean, I guess, you know, does that distinction between aristocratic and democratic, do you think that's an accurate way of looking at it?
Yeah, Jeff, I think that is. It's there's a Montaigne says, I present an ordinary life, and ordinary life is worth reading about, thinking about, trying to live. Now, And in this sense, there's something very democratic about what he's doing. He thinks that human life is not lived best by trying to fly high, but trying to walk at a natural pace, is I think one of the images that he uses for this. Now, there is something, Montaigne was an aristocrat, he lived in a chateau. And there is something aristocratic about his vision of this life, in the sense Montaigne doesn't have to work for a living. That's one of the things that allows him to put together this very sort of life of artful dabbling, if you will. He can deploy his time in this way, but in that leveling of his activities and not taking anything too seriously and practicing the virtue of what he calls nonchalance, that is not getting too wound up about any of his particular pursuits, He's democratizing the activities that make a human life worth living and bringing happiness into the reach of everyone. I think that's fair.
Yeah, and is it a, I mean, just another way to, you know, that I was sort of puzzling through it, is it a more of a social conception of flourishing? You know, that is, that do we find happiness for Montaigne more through friendship and through society, or is it more sort of a conception to withdraw into oneself and contemplation and long hours of reading books and so forth?
It's that's good. I think it's more individualistic than it is social, but this is not an easy question, in the sense that, you know, when you, so Montaigne is he's very preoccupied with the study of himself. He says, I write about myself more than any other subject. He says, I roll around in myself, I taste myself. He has these great lines about this kind of thing. And he tells us that he's very happy when he's alone, and he's perfectly happy to live in this way. He doesn't want to celebrate a life of solitary contemplation, because that's too high-minded for Montaigne. It's like, yeah, sure, I do some thinking, I do a little reading, but I ride around on the horse, I do all kinds of stuff. He consistently wants to emphasize. And on that side, on the individualistic side, Montaigne is very emphatic that he can be happy alone. On the other hand, there's lots of material in the essays about his various kinds of social engagements. So he celebrates what he calls commerce with books and with friends, and he talks about his love affairs and his family. But I think when you look at most of his social relations, specifically love and family, he comes off looking like a pretty cold fish. So he writes this long autobiographical book in which he makes almost no mention of his wife or his daughter. They're there, but not very much. That could be just a matter of a kind of politeness, a kind of discretion with respect to them. But still, it ends up with a portrait of a life in which family is not very important. That's what I mean when I say he looks kind of cold. The one exception to this is his great chapter on friendship, in which he celebrates his friendship with a man named Étienne de la Boétie, who he served together with in in one of the regional parliaments of French government, in his younger years, and it's a wonderful chapter. Alexander Nahamas has said that it contains the best sentence about friendship ever written, which is this sentence in which he says, you know, if he's trying to give an account of the reason for their friendship, all he can say is, because it was he, because it was I, because it was he, because it was I. What does this mean? So I think what Montaigne is doing, he's saying, look, I loved my friend because he was Étienne de la Boétie, and he loved me for the same reason, because I am Michel de Montaigne. And you can't find another, you can't account for the friendship in terms of any other reason. And so this is a big departure from an Aristotelian conception of friendship, in which there are friendships that exist for the sake of utility or for the sake of virtue or for the sake of pleasure, but there's always some third thing that mediates between the friends, right? Like, you know, this friend and I are, I don't know, drinking buddies, and this friend and I are philosophy buddies, and this friend and I, well, this guy helps me move. You know, we have these various kinds of friendship which have a kind of external aim. Montaigne is trying to celebrate a version of friendship that is totally self-contained. It's just the two friends. And we've come to think about this as the social dimension of Montaigne's affirmation of the adequacy of the human condition. Montaigne wants to say human life is enough for us. We don't, this is the immanence of his perspective. We don't need grace. The great French literary critic Sainte-Beuve said that what the essays are really about is presenting a picture of nature that is complete without grace. There's natural life can be enough. And so most of the time Montaigne is portraying himself as a man who's sort of happy with the natural possibilities of human life. And friendship is one of these things. It doesn't need to sort of put one on the steps of the Socratic ladder of love, in which we sort of we begin by contemplating one beautiful person, and next thing we know, we're contemplating the form of the beautiful. Now, Montaigne wants his friendship to stay as imminent as his individual life is, and so that's where you see the really strong social dimension of Montaigne's thought, and I think it's an idea that comes back in a number of these other thinkers that we're looking at.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting. I mean, that the affirmation of the natural, it sort of has its pairing, I think, and you discuss this well in the book, you know, Montaigne's introduction of the conception of a self, right? Montaigne is really the first self-realization thinker of the modern age, right? You know, he's opposing a conception of the human being as a soul, and souls have, as you say, you know, the hierarchical view. You step up a ladder in order to achieve higher states of the soul. This is a very different conception of human flourishing, where you go inside the soul, right? You discover its depths, and you find, what is distinctive about this self. You be authentic, right? And so that, you know, makes sense of the friendship view. If that's true, yes. if your conception is that of a self and being authentic, then of course your friendship is going to respect the authenticity of the other self, and it's going to be about the other self, right?
That's right. And I think one of the really interesting things about Montaigne is that he follows Socrates and other thinkers in putting the quest for self-knowledge at the center of his intellectual enterprise. But for Socrates, I think the quest for self-understanding is a quest for understanding of soul, and it's a quest for understanding human beings as such. You know, so it's a question about, one might say, it's a question about the nature of something, the nature of man. Montaigne, he is really focused on the self, on me. And there's an important linguistic turn here. So the self in French is le moi. And Montaigne doesn't coin abstractions. He hates abstractions. And so he doesn't put the le in front of the moi like that. But what he does is he legitimates discussion of moi. That is there's a traditional literary taboo on the first person. And Montaigne violates that taboo about 8,000 times in the essays. I mean, he says me, he does it constantly. And the funny thing is that he manages not to look vain in the course of doing this, which is why I think that taboo once existed and is still sort of with us in some ways. So he legitimates discussion of me, and he makes it look like I'm not asking universal questions like Socrates. I'm just investigating myself. And interestingly enough, by framing it that way, he makes it look like a kind of act of modesty to talk about oneself, because one's not being pretentious and talking about the whole. And so this is the sort of, this is the Montaignean kind of turn toward the self. And it's his way of legitimating his own activity of autobiography, right? Because that now becomes essential to the quest for self-knowledge. Conversation, like Socrates was constantly engaged in, that's really important if you're trying to find things that are sort of universally true about human beings. You have to test it out with other people. For Montaigne, he's trying to find out the particular truth about himself. And so he makes that turn inward.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I find this so fascinating because it's, you know, different, as you know, there are different kind of narratives of modernity and where modernity starts. And it strikes me that I haven't spent much time with Montaigne, frankly, but, you know, this is, sounds so right to think of Montaigne as kind of an originary figure of a certain tradition of modernity, which is this turn towards subjectivity. I mean, it comes out in Descartes, right? Descartes a little bit later than Montaigne, is that right?
Yeah.
Read Montaigne, I'm sure. And, you know, so that turn towards subjectivity and the focus on the depths of the subject, as opposed to some sort of connection to a broader chain of being, that's definitely there. I mean, I wanted to ask you about kind of a different narrative of modernity, as it were, and the sort of connection between Montaigne and that, which is, I guess you could call it, as opposed to the French tradition, more of an Anglo-American tradition. I'm thinking, like, you know, say John Locke's view of, you know, kind of bourgeois capitalist flourishing, right? To just put it in very crude terms. That is, you know, if you have Montaigne's view, which is about the self and about idleness and leisure, how does that connect with this other kind of maybe even more familiar form of modern happiness, which is this sort of industriousness, finding oneself through one's labor, externalizing oneself through property and merit and so forth. I mean, do you think those are connected or are they separate?
That's a really good question. Let me actually start with the first thing you're saying, which concerns Montaigne's status as a kind of fountainhead figure. Montaigne's essays were probably the most widely read book in Europe during the 17th and much of the 18th century. If you name a major thinker, and almost all of them have read Montaigne, and you can see clearly his traces in them. So, you know, you could see Descartes and Hobbes borrowing from him word for word. You know, Shakespeare and Ben Jonson seem to have shared a copy of Montaigne. Emerson loves him, and Virginia Woolf loves him, and Nietzsche loves him, and David Hume couldn't be David Hume without him. And it's, you know, that there's, so he's not that much read in the Anglo-American tradition, but he's right there behind a great deal of what we do read. And so in this sense, I think he does deserve a status as a kind of foundational figure in terms of his influence. And more than that, in terms of playing out a certain conjunction of ideas, Montaigne is a famous skeptic and makes a very powerful case for skepticism. And then he lives out the consequences of skepticism in this vision of happiness that he lays out for us, this dabbling kind of happiness. If we think about it, it's like, I think that one of our common narratives of modernity goes something like this. We have this sort of skeptical moment that maybe starts with Montaigne, continues through figures like Locke and Hume. And if you're a skeptic on the question of the highest good, if you're a skeptic on the question of what makes a human life worth living, I think our usual way of thinking about this is that that opens us up to a plurality of ways of life. And there's a certain truth to that. But on the other hand, if you're a skeptic about all visions of the human good, what's the most obvious way to live in the light of that? Well, it's not to pick. it's to try to dabble your way to happiness. And so there's a famous line in Locke about, you know, it's foolish to try to satisfy all men's palates with cheese or with lobsters. And so, you know, Locke is basically saying like, yeah, let the lobster people have the lobster and let the cheese people have the cheese. I think the more natural way to think about it, though, is that like I'd like a little cheese and then a little lobster, right? Is that I'd like, I don't want to pick. I want to have a little bit of both. And so I think that's the Montaignean vision. And I think we see this all around us. I think that's one of the things that's helpful about going back to Montaigne, is understanding the reason why so many of us try to dabble our ways to happiness. It's not necessarily because Montaigne directly influenced us. It's because it's a natural way to think if you're a skeptic, right? It just comes easily to sort of equalize the goods in this sense. So with respect to Montaigne's relationship to that that English tradition or Anglo-American tradition that you were referring us to, I think the difference is largely that the Anglo-American tradition points in a more commercial and more democratic direction and is a tradition of people who are thinking about working. And so when Locke has his famous line about God giving the world to the use of the industrious and rational, you know, Locke doesn't tell us, I don't think, what the aims of human life ought to be, but he focuses on rewarding those who secure the conditions, the material conditions for living a certain kind of good life. And if you think about Montaignean sort of dabbling vision of happiness, material resources are very useful for that. Right. So like a more heroic vision of happiness, this is the one thing needful. This is the one thing I'm going to focus on. Well, you don't necessarily need a lot of wealth for that. But if you're going to try to do a little reading and a little traveling and have a nice dinner every now and then and sample some good wines, then, well, you know, a little money doesn't hurt. And so I think there's a shift with a change in social and political conditions toward a vision of life that is focused on acquiring the material conditions for an imminent kind of happiness. But that dabbling vision of happiness is nonetheless often contained within that sort of Lockean striving.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it sort of reminds me a little bit. Isn't this David Brooks who sort of coined that Bobo's notion? You know, the idea that you can be a bourgeois and a bohemian at the same time, right? But you can combine the Lockean bourgeois with this more of a bohemian, it's a sort of Montanian living in all sorts of different ways of vitalness and leisure, and it's combinable, as you say, because it's sort of implicit within that bourgeois tradition is that kind of relativism about the good, or a kind of self-realization view.
Yeah, no, that's very good. Montaigne has been celebrated, or was celebrated and decried as the first bourgeois, which is given that he's an aristocrat, it's an interesting fact. But that is, because he makes a kind of self-centered version of, no heroism kind of version of happiness look attractive. People have seen him in that light. But I hadn't thought of this until you mentioned it, that he's also a kind of bohemian figure, because he's not focused on like the domestic virtues, and he's not focused on work. So those are, those are two things, part of the bourgeois vision that aren't present there. But these two things can be combined, that they often are combined. And I might go far enough to say that the bourgeois, in these combinations, the bourgeois element is almost always dominant. I think we can, you put together a Montaignean vision of happiness and the need to make a living, that's what you get.
Great. Let's talk about Pascal, where you get the first major criticism of this kind of view, the Montaignean kind of view. Maybe you could start just by sketching, what it is that Pascal saw problematic about this Montaignean vision of happiness.
Yeah, I think that, I came to Pascal relatively late in studies that we did to create this book, and I think he's the most neglected figure that we treat, the most neglected in terms of the tradition of political philosophy that you and I both teach. I think the first thing that one has to say about Pascal is just to remind people of who he is, because he's an astonishing figure. The Chateaubriand called him a frightening genius, and that's right. So Pascal has world historical accomplishments in geometry with his work on the problem called the cycloid and his book on conic sections. He's the founder of the branch of mathematics called probability theory, Pascal's triangle, which is this arithmetic sequence that he lays out in the form of a triangle. That is thought of as the basis of that. Pascal was also a great physicist, did experiments on the vacuum and demonstrated that nature does not, in fact, abhor a vacuum as the old scholastic commonplace had it. Because of this work, units of pressure are to this day called Pascals. Pascal also invented the world's first working calculator, a mechanical device that could add, subtract, multiply, and divide numbers of up to 8 digits. He did all this while he was a very young man. And then he shifted gears and started writing literary polemics, these provincial letters that he wrote, which are these fantastic satires of the most powerful churchmen in France at the time, the Jesuits. And they're also very theologically precise, and Pascal is a very serious theological thinker. But he's just such an accomplished satirist that somebody like Voltaire, who doesn't agree with Pascal about theological matters in the least, nonetheless helped make the provincial letters into one of the great classics of French literature. Then Pascal wrote the Pensées, which are, on the one hand, one could describe them as the foundational work of existentialist philosophy and one of the greatest apologetics for the Christian religion ever written. And then at the end of his life, Pascal gave Paris the world's first system of public transportation called the 5-cent carriages. So he died at 40, or I think not quite 40. And so this is, you know, Pascal, the first thing to know about Pascal is just like in terms of contributing to the great modern project for the relief of man's estate, as a philanthropist, as a scientist, as a mathematician, as a belles lettres in the French, you know, Pascal is just an astonishingly accomplished mind. Like, you know, this is a great contributor to the modern project. And he looks at Montaigne's modern vision of happiness and he says, oh, come on. this can't possibly be right. And what he's looking at is, you know, he's raised in a sort of Montaignean context. He's in the kind of the low aristocracy, the high bourgeois, that sort of celebrates itself on its accomplishments and its refinements of taste and its pleasures. And he looks around at his friends in this world and he says, come on, guys, you're fooling yourself. You can't make yourself happy by trying to dabble your way to it. The human soul is both greater and more miserable than you're letting on. What you're doing is engaging in diversion. And that diversion is like, he's got this great image for it. He describes it as like, we're like, you know, we're mortal. We're headed toward death. And we're like people who are like running toward a cliff, but put something up in front of our faces to prevent us from seeing it until we go over. That's what the Montaignean vision of happiness is. On Pascal's understanding. And he wants us to be much more demanding in terms of what we're looking for out of human life.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm just thinking about how Montaigne might respond to this, because the first thing that strikes me just based on your description there, what's so bad about a little illusion, right? I mean, if you can put something in front of yourself, I mean, Montaigne might welcome that in a sense that, you know, if the striving for greatness is not accessible to everyone, maybe a little bit of an illusion mm-hmm. that can get some measure of happiness might be preferable. But I mean, I guess the other thing that strikes me is, you know, isn't part of Montaigne's, you know, argument that it's a certain kind of outlook on the world, a religious outlook that, inclines us to this view of human flourishing, that if we change our attitude, we change our worldview, as it were, then we can maybe find more satisfaction with the everyday. I mean, I don't know if you think, you know, that's a right way to characterize Montaigne, or if there's something else, and how Pascal might respond to that.
Yeah. 2 points there, Jeff. I think you're exactly right on how, you know, Montaigne would respond to Pascal. He'd say, you know, Pascal is concerned with salvation, eternity, and Montaigne would say this is one more diversion. But I think, with respect to the other part of your question, I think I want to respond in this way. I don't think that Pascal's vision is a vision that one can only take seriously if one accepts his theological conclusions from the outset. In other words, Pascal is in the first place an anthropological thinker. That is, he's in the first place somebody who is trying to look hard at man and trying to get human beings to look hard at themselves. And so there's much of the pensée that has been received into the broader philosophic tradition, and as little a theological thinker as Nietzsche will say, like, well, look, Pascal sees some stuff. There's some very, very powerful observations in this guy. And so what Pascal wants to say is, if you look an honest look at the human condition, at our greatness and our misery, at the gap between what we want and what we get, is the first step in a process of what he calls anguish seeking. So Pascal says we all feel like deposed kings. We feel like a great lord who has fallen and somebody else is in their place. And so it's like, you know, we're walking around like I ought to be in charge, but I'm not. and there's this huge gap between what we want and what we get. So we want happiness, we get misery. We want life, we get death. And most importantly, we want knowledge and truth, and we get ignorance. And I think this comes back to your question about the utility of illusions. Pascal would say, we can't help wanting to live truly. This is built into us. And so we can try to fob ourselves off. But the problem is that we can't actually fool ourselves. And so this is part of that his sense that human beings innately desire to live truly is part of the case that he makes that a Montaignean anthropology and vision of happiness is just not adequate to describing who we are.
Right. There's a natural restlessness to human life, a sort of restlessness for what? For the truth or for the eternal, something that, you know, we always seek to, is it driven by a desire to know, or what is it driven by a desire for happiness for Pascal, this desire to overcome, you know, all forms of transitoriness to achieve the eternal? That's that longing, restlessness is there implicit. So is it connected to knowledge for Pascal? Is it connected to flourishing, happiness? What is it?
I think life, you know, I'd put out these three things together as you're describing it: life, flourishing, happiness. Excuse me, life, happiness, and knowledge. I think Pascal ultimately thinks these things come together. In what St. Thomas Aquinas might describe as the vision of the divine essence. I think he thinks that knowing and living and being happy ultimately become one.
One of the reasons that I ask about sort of Pascal's view is I wonder how compatible it is with other religious outlooks on the world, right? I mean, it's a Pascal as a kind of Christian understanding of a sort, but is the view flourishing specifically Christian, or is it, you know, compatible with other religions or spirituality in general?
It's very specifically Christian. I think what Pascal wants to get people to see is, let me put it this in terms of his treatment of philosophy. So Pascal gathers all of philosophy into two great camps, the skeptics on the one hand and the dogmatists on the other. And he says the dogmatists are really impressive. They make major moral demands on themselves, and they sometimes live up to those demands. But the dogmatists, on his understanding, ultimately founder on the subject of pride, and they can't answer the question of the skeptics' doubts. The skeptics can always poke holes in whatever it is the dogmatists are being dogmatic about. And then he says to the skeptics, and here Montaigne is the principal figure that he's got in mind. He says, well, like, look, you guys ask lots of great questions. However, you end up in hedonism and despair. That is, because you don't have an answer to the question of the good life, you end up just doing what feels good. And that is ultimately really, really depressing on his understanding. And so it's like the skeptics, one could say, illustrate the misery of human life. The dogmatists illustrate the greatness of human possibility, even though they do have this problem of pride. And what Pascal sees in the God-man of Nazareth is this combination of unsurpassable greatness, right? Like God in the flesh, right? Like what could be greater than that? And the most extreme misery, the death of a criminal inflicted on God. the extremes come together in this person for Pascal. And what he's trying to do is get human beings to see themselves as asking a question to which that vision that combines greatness and misery so powerfully is the answer. And so, I mean, I think it's helpful to see Pascal as a kind of Socratic figure, somebody who's really trying hard to philosophize rationally and thinks that the questions that philosophy asks ultimately point beyond philosophy itself. That is, the more honestly we philosophize, the more open we become to religion and Christianity particularly. So with respect to that part of your question, Pascal says, he's talking about deism in one place, and he says, deism is as far from Christianity as atheism. These are not at all the same thing. But I think it's particularly on the basis of the notion of a personal God and a God who undergoes incarnation, which is really very different from anything that one might find from a deistic thinker.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it does raise this other question about the you know, about the role of philosophy in Pascal's own view, because I mean, one way to ask the question is, you know, how does he stand towards previous, you know, Christian thinkers like Aquinas, who is kind of rationalist, right? I mean, is it, you know, is Aquinas, you know, does he not measure up? And then I guess, you know, this sort of rationalism that you can see implicit in Pascal's own view, right? Like, I mean, his probably most famous thing everybody knows about is Pascal's wager, which is kind of, you know, a rationalist argument for not the existence of God, but for rationally believing in God. And now you have an interesting reading of the wager and how it fits into his system. So that I'm curious if you know sort of elaborate on the role of rationalism in a system and how he relates to sort of rationalist philosophical tradition.
That's a great question. And so with respect to the relationship between Pascal and Thomas Aquinas, I think one could say of these two Christian thinkers, Pascal thinks the fall is much deeper than Thomas Aquinas does. So, for example, Pascal thinks we don't know natural law, which is, of course, at the center of Thomas Aquinas's thinking about moral and political questions. He thinks we might have known it once, but after the fall, we can't see it anymore. And in this, it's very interesting. He's following Montaigne really closely. And so he suggests that there's a kind of radical relativism to human customs, that people sometimes think murder is okay. They sometimes justify cannibalism. You know, there's no common ground in human moral customs. And that's a view that he very much gets from Montaigne. And so in this sense, there's a big, big difference between Montaigne and St. Thomas in the sense of the depth of the fall that Pascal thinks has happened. And this is probably one of the reasons why Pascal spent hundreds of years on the Index of Forbidden Books, although he wanted to think of himself as Catholic and never broke with the church. The church broke with him. And so it's that's perhaps one reason for that. Although it should be pointed out that Pope Francis has recently talked about the possibility of canonizing Pascal, which is an interesting possibility. Pascal's rationalism and the wager. Pascal's rationalism is, above all, I think, an anthropological rationalism, an attempt to look at human phenomena squarely, that I think he thinks drives us on this anguished quest that he describes. Once we're embarked on that quest, I think the wager occupies one particular point, which is that Pascal thinks, if we've accepted, like, look, I'm not making myself happy with my clubs and my hobbies and my nice dinners and my little pleasures and my curiosities. If we accepted that and we think we have to look for a much more substantive kind of happiness than the Montaignean vision thereof, he thinks that we might come to a point where we have a kind of rational objection to the possibility of eternity, which says, am I really going to bet here and now for something that I can't see or touch? You know, why would I do that? And Pascal here does weighing a mathematical calculation of probabilities and values that leads him to suggest, like, look, betting the rest of your life for the possibility of eternity just makes sense. Because he describes the rest of our lives as like 10 years trying hard to please people and failing, which is, I think, really sharp. He says, well, why wouldn't you bet that for the possibility of eternity? And he's a mathematical thinker who's like, look, do the proportions. Eternity is obviously worth it, is the suggestion there. But I think I think this logic only holds for somebody who's already embarked on Pascal's quest. But I think there's a part of it that is really very powerful for anybody. And this is the suggestion that human life is, in fact, a wager. The BU professor, Peter Kraft, has a nice image of this. He notices the importance of this word in Pascal. He says, you're embarked. That is, we're like people on a ship that is going past a harbor. And that's that the water that's moving us, that's like time. And we can decide to turn into the harbor, or we cannot decide to turn into the harbor. That is, you know, if the harbor is, let's say, the Christian way of life. But not choosing is not an option, right? Because you're either going to turn in or you're not. And so in this sense, agnosticism is not really a thing on Pascal's understanding. And so he suggests to us that because human life is mortal and finite, you're necessarily going to bet it on something. You are going to pursue a vision of happiness. And so you can think that through, or you cannot think it through, but you can't avoid having such a vision. And you can't avoid staking your life on something. That's, in that sense, I think the notion of the wager is something that, you know, without engaging in Pascal's specific calculations, that we find in that thought, we can see has a certain purchase.
Yeah, good. And it's, you know, I mean, it's helpful to hear you talk about Pascal and this sort of anthropological, the centrality of that to his thought. It's really helpful, and the skepticism, the heritage of Montaigne is helpful to bring out his modern character, right? This is a character who's emphatically modern in this way, but bringing out the sort of internal limitations of the modern project, especially the ethical project. I mean, let's talk about Rousseau, who's the next figure in thinking about the internal problems of modernity. A thinker who, you know, fair to say, has been much, much more extensively treated than Pascal in political theory these days. I was quite taken by your discussion of Rousseau here and placing him in dialogue with Montaigne and Pascal, and how Rousseau is a kind of mediating figure in this debate between Montaigne and Pascal, that he takes up Pascal's critique of the modern age, although changes it, makes it more socio-political rather than, you know, religious or spiritual in character, and which allows a kind of space for the possibility of a Montaignean authenticity or sincerity. Maybe you could sort of elaborate on your argument here.
Yeah, it's I have to acknowledge a debt here to John Scott, who's a really important political philosopher and scholar of Rousseau in particular. I once heard John say at a conference, you can go through the history of French thought and you can basically categorize people. This one's a Montaigne guy, this one's a Pascal guy. Montaigne guy, Pascal guy, Montaigne guy, Pascal guy. Until you get to Rousseau. And then it's like, oh, he's somehow both. And so I think what the way that we've thought about Rousseau here is that, on the one hand, Rousseau accepts Pascal's critique of the Montaignean pursuit of happiness. This is, I think, at the center of his famous quarrel with Voltaire. Voltaire's, you know, that his wonderful poem, The Worldling, is very much an instantiation of the Montaignean vision of happiness, but, you know, achieved through the a variety of kind of refined pleasures. And Rousseau, like Pascal, says, "Oh, come on! That's not what human beings are built for. This is not enough for the human heart." But he has a very different way of understanding the nature of our falling short of happiness by trying to pursue it in this way, and that different understanding of the nature of our falling short is related to or rooted in the thing about which he agrees with Montaigne, which is the possibility of natural happiness. That is, Rousseau, like Montaigne, does not think human beings need grace to perfect their lives. And so he tries to come up with a version of natural imminent contentment that will withstand the Pascalian critique. What he actually comes up with is many versions of this, which he gets to by identifying the human problem as a problem of dividedness and coming up with a series of recipes for recovering our wholeness. And I think that's our way of conceiving of what Rousseau calls his sad and great system, and this remark that Rousseau's thought is a system has been really, which and you know, his thought can seem like not a system. I mean, he wrote like an opera and a novel and an education book and a social contract, and you know, he's all over the place. But he insists that it actually holds together, and I think that's right. Although I think it holds together in a complex and even tragic way.
Yeah, I want to talk about the overall picture in a second, but you know, before getting there, I just wanted to zoom in on. You know, one of your discussions of Rousseau in the chapter is about, the Emile, and specifically about the love between Emile and Sophie that's there. And you point out how Rousseau is, you know, one of the legacies of Rousseau's thought is really to sort of bring out this sort of, the familial, the domestic form of satisfaction that exists, and that's exhibited there in the Emile, and in the book you say the sort of familial content, this quote from the book, familiar contentment of Emile and Sophie perhaps speaks most powerfully to the longings of the modern heart. Yeah. Right, so this is one of those forms of restlessness that's so familiar, is a restlessness towards our erotic restlessness for a pair, for a love. Maybe you could talk about, Rousseau's view here, as expresses it in the Emile, about, because it's, it's a part of the Emile I don't think that we talk about all that much, which the sort of books 4 and 5 of it, and how his, the view of romance and love sort of illuminates this part of the modern soul, but also, poses a challenge to this form of satisfaction.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. What I think we see in Emile is an attempt to remedy a problem that Rousseau describes in the Second Discourse, where Rousseau is telling the story of human development in the Second Discourse. He describes erotic life as initially not anything that could really be described as erotic. It's just occasional coupling with no meaning, no particular longing behind it. Just, it just happens every now and then, and there's population, and nobody makes a very big deal about the whole thing. But Rousseau describes our social development as bound up with our psychic development, our intellectual development, and he thinks this whole process is deeply mixed. And so while we become, he describes the discovery of the family or the creation of the family in the Second Discourse as productive of the sweetest sentiments known to the human heart, which are paternal and conjugal love. But he sees this as having come into being through the same process that amour propre is developed, that pride is developed, and that pride will eventually be fatal to erotic happiness as well as many other kinds of human happiness, because we start living outside of ourselves, living in the opinions of other people, and this makes it very hard for us to be loyal to anybody else, but also makes it very hard for us to be happy. And so the project of Emile is to show a way to recover wholeness, in this case, the wholeness of a couple. And so Rousseau has this wonderful picture of the whole formed by a couple. If you'll allow me, I'll just read a paragraph of his. He says, "The social relation of the sexes is admirable. From this society results a moral person, of whom the woman is the eye and the man the arm, but with such a dependence on one another that it is from the man that the woman learns what must be seen, and it is from the woman that the man learns what must be done. If woman could ascend to principles as well as man, and man had a mind for details as good as hers, they would be always independent of one another and would live in eternal discord, and their society could not subsist. But in the harmony that reigns between them, everything tends to the common end. One does not know who contributes most. Each follows the impulsion of the other, each obeys, and both are masters." It's a really sort of, I mean, although there are elements of it that are hardly feminist or egalitarian, and which many of us might object to now. Nonetheless, it's a picture of the couple as an almost organic whole. And of course, he can achieve this in Emile only by very carefully raising Emile to be a certain sort of human being who is capable of this, and doing the same for Sophie. They are both built to form a whole in this way. And then the really depressing thing is that it falls apart. There's this unpublished sequel to Emile called Emile and Sophie, and the subtitle is The Solitaries, in which, you know, it's really Pascalian, actually, in a way. Sophie's parents die, they have a kid, and their child dies. And to console her, Emile takes her to Paris, of all places. Like, and Paris is like the boogeyman of Emile, the boogeyman of Rousseau's life. And so I'm like, what are you doing? Is sort of the question that comes up when Emile does this. And so, and you know, she cheats on him, and they fall apart, and it's a disaster. And it's kind of a tragic end to this this happiness, but it's, you know, mortality and diversion come to, that's what he's trying to do when he takes her to Paris, and that's what I mean by describing it as a Pascalian turn of events. But yeah, I think this desire for household wholeness for the contented couple is something we see very powerfully alive among us. And I think we can understand, for example, something about the heat of our marriage debates by understanding how important it is for people to form something like this. You know, it's a funny thing about American life or democratic life in general. You know, when I think that, you know, you could describe Emile and Sophie as soulmates, and you could describe Montaigne and La Boétie in the same way. That is, these are people who come together and they form this really distinctive whole, and it's something that is the production of their own choice and will. And Montaigne, in describing his union with La Boétie, says this is something that comes along once every three centuries, this kind of soulmate thing. But the funny thing about modern democratic societies is that everybody's got to find this. and if you don't, then you have to live in an apartment by yourself while you're getting really old. It's really tough. And so I think the quest for the soulmate, while it can produce wonderful things, like, you know, I think I got to, you know, marry somebody who it's great. And, you know, it's not an arranged marriage or anything like that. Nonetheless, like it's all or nothing, right? You get the soulmate, or you're alone, and that's one of the hardest things I think about modern freedom.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, Rousseau, so that, you know, he both reveals how important it is to us, and this is, I mean, regularly you hear people talk about it's the sense in which their family, their children, are the things that are most important to them, most crucial, not their jobs, not being a citizen, or, you know, et cetera, but it's their families that make them, you know, give them meaning in life. But on the other hand, as you say, there's a kind of, you know, accentuation of the importance of finding the exact right person to marry, you know, building the perfect kid, right? Such that, you know, both on the one hand, you have ratcheted up expectations for the family, but also much, much more difficult to achieve. And that's very Rousseauan thought and very, very, very illustrative. I mean, and as you say, it's tragic. And I mean, I wanted to ask you about this tragedy line that you run with Rousseau, sort of in what sense then are we to think about that lesson for us? Is the idea that, okay, Rousseau's revealing sort of tragic dividedness of the modern age. So does that mean we should chasten our expectations or despair about finding the right family? Or how do you think that translating that notion of tragedy sort of for a lesson for modern human life, what would that look like?
Yeah, I'd say to understand the tragic character of Rousseau's thought, we have to zoom out beyond Emile and Sophie and think about the other famous alternatives in Rousseau. So he famously wrote a autobiography called The Reveries of a Solitary Walker, in which he celebrates the possibility of solitary happiness, which is the most natural form of Rousseauan happiness. And the other thing he's most famous for, at least in terms of his political thought, is his celebration of the citizen, who is totally wedded to his political community and thinks of himself entirely in terms of that social whole. And what we realized in the course of studying Rousseau is how strange that the same author presents us with both of these alternatives, which are radically opposed to one another. And also, you can't be a solitary and be Emile the family man. You can't be a solitary and be a citizen. There are just these tremendous tensions between the alternatives Rousseau presents us with. The funny thing is, like, you know, there's this concern about bourgeois dividedness that Rousseau begins from, but he makes it worse, right? Because it's like, well, you know, you just like keep kicking yourself for not being a better citizen, a better family man, and a better like solitary, authentic self, all at the same time. And so in this sense, I think, you know, what the result of any, you know, fairly comprehensive encounter with Rousseau's system is to deepen the very dividedness that is the starting point of Rousseau's social critique. And so, you know, what we try to argue on the basis of what we've seen from Rousseau here is that this is a very powerful demonstration of how much one can see about human life by imagining it in these kind of horizontal terms, right? That we're stretched out between the poles of society and the individual. And Rousseau can see an awful lot by picturing us in this, by picturing our human problems in that way. But he doesn't really have any answer to these kinds of problems, which is one of the reasons that we think it might be more helpful to think of our lives with a kind of vertical dimension, which one might do in terms of the hierarchy of soul you mentioned as we were getting started here, and one might also obviously do in religious terms.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, I was thinking in terms of the, you know, one of the, of course, lines from Rousseau is this, you could call it a revolutionary form of flourishing. That is that, you know, Rousseau inaugurates a way of thinking. You could see it in a number of different places, but I guess the great legislator, you know, from the social contract, the way that sort of remakes society entirely becomes a longing, a form of restlessness that you talk about. And I mean, I you can see that, of course, in perennial story about young people, but you certainly can see it in young people after Rousseau, is that longing for, you know, to change things in the world and find satisfaction there. I mean, I'm wondering if, you know, how your view of the tragic view of Rousseau sort of squares with that more revolutionary view. Is that, you know, is the more tragic understanding of Rousseau like a could be a response to those young people who come to you and say, "Hey, I want to be a revolutionary," or, you know, what were your thoughts on that?
That's good. And thankfully, Jeff, you've reminded me of the thing I forgot when we were talking about Pascal. because I want to talk about the specifically modern version of restlessness, and that's what had escaped my mind. So what Pascal sees with respect to the Montaignean pursuit of happiness is this. Drives us into a more kind of frantic kind of restlessness. Because if you think about it, if you give up on the question of the summum bonum before you even start your quest for happiness, you've sort of accepted that all the goods that you're enjoying are empty before the game even begins. And so, you know, it's like there is no answer to the question of the good life. And so I'm doing this, but I know it's not the answer. You know, I'm gambling or whatever it is, but I know this is not going to make me happy. And I know that before I even start. And so, you know, people caught in that predicament are naturally going to be very uneasy. You know, restlessness is, of course, something that abides for much longer. Saint Augustine described himself as restless. I think we could describe Socrates as restless in a certain way. I think the difference between those ancient understandings of restlessness and this more modern vision of it that we're trying to describe here is that Augustine, Socrates, these are people on a quest. They're very focused, and they are quite willing to say, if this thing that I'm doing, if pleasure or honor doesn't satisfy, well, I gotta let it go and turn to something better. And that's the kind of vision I think Pascal is trying to recover. Now, with respect to your, so that's what I wanted to say about the specifically modern kind of restlessness. Respect to your Pascal, with your Rousseau question and the question of revolution. Yeah, I think, you know, I'm convinced that a more comprehensive view of Rousseau is a less revolutionary view of Rousseau. That is, because one starts to see all the problems that show up with all the alternatives that he sets forth, and I think he's aware of those problems. So if you look at his quest for solitary happiness, for example, he keeps showing you the ways in which he fails. Even while he's celebrating this, he's like, yeah, you know, but it was ultimately kind of quixotic and ridiculous. And so, you know, he knows this about himself. And I think we could see the same thing with a number of the political things that are going on in Rousseau. So, for example, you know, the social contract, which seems to be this picture of this celebration of the principles of a kind of ideal republic, there's a great deal of discussion of the inevitability of political decline, in the social contract, which I think would tamp down sort of revolutionary expectations. But I think with respect to the sort of personal longings that you're describing, the quest for immanent contentment is a quest to be content, to feel like you've got enough here and now. And of course, people don't feel like they've got enough here and now. And sometimes they look to politics as the source of that problem, and they want a different and better politics. And of course, wanting a different and better politics is sometimes a very reasonable thing to ask for. But it can also be a misguided way of attacking the problem of our own discontent.
Right. Well, yeah. I see it these days in the sense that, I mean, at least I see it in some students who are restless about justice in general.
Yes.
And, any achievement, in other words, towards justice is still not enough. I mean, this is a nice transition to Tocqueville, because I'm reminded of the Tocqueville effect that people talk about. You know, the closer you come to equality, the more the remaining inequalities become magnified, and the more sort of discontent and restlessness is aroused in order to eliminate those remaining inequalities. But in any case, I bring this up just as another form of restlessness that in a certain sense is born by Rousseau, but perhaps Rousseau doesn't really have an answer to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead, Jeff. Okay.
No. I don't know if there was a question there exactly, but it's more of a sense that, you know, it seems to me this is one of the, let me put it this way. You started, I think, the conversation, you start the book with, this is a restlessness among our students, which is
yes.
A restlessness about what they're going to do with their lives. But there's also a restlessness among our students, and you see it all over the place today. And, you know, it's even beyond the universities now, but, you know, a restlessness about justice. And maybe that is the right answer to how to live one's life, but it's also sometimes makes one unhappy because you can never be quite content with the world as it is, that the world is itself always a place without justice.
That's very good, Jeff. And I think the sharpest insight on this is a Pascalian one. Pascal is responding to Montaigne, and Montaigne says, he's got this great line. He says, the laws are not laws because they are just. The laws are laws because they are laws. That is the source of their authority. They have no other, and that's good. And so, you know, Montaigne is saying in this little jingle, he's saying, there is, if there's any cosmic justice or natural justice or divine justice, we can't find it. And so what? The politics is always going to be somewhat arbitrary. It's always going to be conventional. Those conventions don't really have any foundation. But, you know, it's better than breaking everything up is kind of is this kind of ironic attitude that he takes toward this whole thing. And Pascal looks at that and he says, no, Montaigne, you've again misjudged what the human heart is really about. And so we might add to the list that we were talking about earlier, that human beings want life and happiness and knowledge. Well, they also want justice, and they can't help wanting justice. There's no overcoming our desire for justice on Pascal's understanding. And I think we see this every time we think somebody does this an injustice. The, you know, skeptic though we may be, the ironic or you know, the over all that, you know, as we may be, when somebody cuts us off in traffic, all of a sudden we believe in justice and that guy just violated it. The somebody ought to do something about it. The, you know, so this desire for justice is very natural to us. I think with respect to the, you know, the very sort of white hot version of this that we often see among our students, one thing I think that one place that I think Tocqueville is really helpful is Tocqueville is very aware of the injustices of American society. The longest chapter of Democracy in America is a chapter about slavery and the dispossession of Native Americans. But Tocqueville is also very aware of the accomplishments of American democracy and just how much, and just what an actually an unusual historical degree of justice exists in modern liberal democratic societies. And I think he's able to see this because he looks at our modern liberal democratic societies in this broad historical perspective that makes democracy in America so famous. I think it might help some of our students appreciate the accomplishments of modern liberal democratic governments to actually spend more time looking at getting outside of America mentally, that is looking seriously at what life has been like, what regimes have been like in other times and places. We're still going to have our American injustices. We should still pay attention to those American injustices and try to make them better. But that could give us a little bit more of a sense of the kinds of things that our American liberal democratic order has actually accomplished, and the ways in which it actually does give lots of people, maybe an unprecedented number of people, a decent shot at a decent human existence.
Good. Yeah, we just have a few minutes left. So we can't treat Tocqueville with the depth he deserves, but I thought maybe you could just say briefly sort of how you envision Tocqueville fitting in to this tradition. You have this sort of Montaigne immanent conception of happiness, Pascal's critique of that, Rousseau's attempt to combine the two, though it ends in a kind of tragedy. I mean, so is Tocqueville, do you envision him as, you know, the sort of figure who can mend the tragedy at the heart of Rousseau, or how does he fit in this trajectory?
That's a really good question. So we see Tocqueville as a kind of student of Montaignism democratized and writ large. And when you democratize the Montaignian quest for immanent contentment and you spread it over a society of millions of people, remember Montaigne was a kind of boutique figure at first, writing for a relatively small section of society. Well, of course, that quest for immanent contentment changes. It becomes really earnest and it becomes really anxious. Pascal thought it was anxious naturally, and I think there's some truth to that. But in America, that anxiety is compounded by the fact of social mobility. Social mobility is great. We can rise. We can also fall, and we don't have any fixed sense of place. And so we're constantly, you know, have you risen far enough? Or could, you know, Jeff Church be a Harvard professor? It's a question that is like,
no, please.
It's, you know, but you can never say, it's very hard for an American ever to say, I've achieved the status that nature intended for me. And so our restlessness is compounded by the kind of social indeterminacy that is actually, in a way, the content of American social freedom. So this is one of the things that Tocqueville sees in America that's not there in, for example, Montaigne's picture of human life. But at the same time, he sees that sense of the varied and indeterminate question of the good that is like so much a part of American life. And so he says, you know, these Americans, when he describes their restlessness in the midst of their prosperity, he says, like, you know, they take one profession and they get fairly far in it, and then they jump ship and they start doing something else. And he's, you know, he's got this great line about how an American will build a house And then he will sell it while the ridgepole is being set. That is, the roof is being put on the top of the house. And so, like, you wanted the house and you've achieved the house. And then you're like, nah, you give it up. This is so moving to me because we did this. We bought a house. We fixed it all up. We put a new roof on it and we sold it, which is just like, it's so American. We don't know how to sit still. And I think that's something that Tocqueville sees really, really powerfully.
That's great. I wanted to sort of just close by asking your sort of general thoughts about the trajectory of things in America, or more generally. We're just maybe emerging from a pandemic here. Maybe that's the place to begin. I mean, have you thought about the character of restlessness and how it's changed in the pandemic? I mean, many of us sort of stayed at home, which is, changed the character of our longing here a little bit, maybe accentuated people's longings or redirected it in certain ways. So what are your thoughts? How has this affected our restlessness?
That's a great question. There's a wonderful line in Tocqueville's Souvenir where he says that revolutions begin from a hidden malady of men's minds, sparked by an unforeseen chance incident. And I think the word for malady there is inquietude, which is the word that translates restlessness. And Tocqueville is in the Souvenir, he's describing a revolution. He's describing the revolution of 1848. And so, of course, this is something that came very much to my mind when I was teaching that book last spring, while there was so much going on in American politics that looked almost revolutionary. And so I think there is a link between the restlessness in our hearts and the agitation of our politics. I think your point about the pandemic and what it did to us, we had to sit home and be still. And I think a lot of us actually from those of us who were lucky enough that the real experience of the pandemic was not getting really sick or losing a loved one, but was sitting at home, we actually learned something really valuable by doing that. Because Pascal thinks, the source of human beings' unhappiness is that they cannot sit in a room by themselves. And a lot of us just had to do an awful lot of that. And Pascal thinks that, if we're willing to sit through those moments, we can actually really discover something by so doing, and that it might actually be essential to a more fruitful kind of pursuit of happiness. And so, we wrote a little piece about this, about how one of the things that we would like to take with us from the pandemic is remembering not to like run off to work at 5 o'clock in the morning every day. sitting still is something intrinsically valuable and something very hard to come by in the life of a busy commercial democracy such as we live in, and that's something that we can that hopefully we more of us will know them as we move forward.
Well, that's a great place to stop, and that was it's been a really great conversation. And let me thank you again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Okay, thanks so much, Jeff. We really appreciate your having me on.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us, and thanks to you for listening.